Find something of value.
The higher education community and South Africa and the unintellectualization.
How central this humanity is.
Welcome to The Academic Citizen. I'm your host, Mahita Ikani. This is a special season dedicated to subantarctic science in South Africa, specifically Marion Island and its surrounding ocean, and some of the scientific work that takes place on land and sea in that territory. In this episode, we'll be exploring more about some of the fauna of Marion Island. In other words, what are the creatures that live there? Why are they special? And what is some of the scientific research that's being done to understand and protect them?
There's a very few subantarctic islands that kind of form a ring around Antarctica. And even though in like surface area, they're very tiny and few of them, they provide really critical breeding grounds to a number of species. So if these like very few islands are not ecologically intact, it has like a disproportionately large impact on the species that they support.
So if you're into birds or insects or even mice, this episode is for you.
My name is Yana Rao. Like Camilla said, the seals and the seabirds are all predators that are like at the top of their food chain, and they're key indicators of what's going on in the ecosystem, like below them and around them.
It's a home for so many seabirds, and the albatross, the petrels, the king penguins, millions of them.
So many
birds. If this island becomes a non-viable breeding ground, these birds will find another place. They'll throw off the carrying capacity there, and the effect could just cascade like that on and on.
So I think a lot of people can think that it's a tiny island, it's in the middle of nowhere, and how can it be that important? But it's a really important part of the whole world's ecosystem.
As you've just heard from some of the field assistants who are currently overwintering on Marion, it is a super special place for research into biodiversity and ecology. Quick note, this is a serialized season, so if you haven't yet listened to episode 1, A Ship, An Island, you might want to catch up on that before diving into this episode. That episode gives some context to what Marion Island is and how we all got there on the SA Agulhas 2. Quick recap, the Prince Edward Islands are two of a number of little islands that form a ring around Antarctica between the latitudes of 40 and 60 degrees south, which is a part of the Southern Ocean that is known for its wild weather and roaring winds. These islands, our islands, are super special ecological treasures on this precious planet of ours. So let's find out more about the creatures that live there on the rocky, cushion plant festooned, marshy and cold terrain of Marion Island. Let's start with the smallest, insects.
So Marion Island is quite a complex, heterogeneous landscape, and it presents a lot of novel opportunities to investigate how the complex landscape actually influences spatial genetic structure.
This is Dr. Daniela Monsanto from the University of Johannesburg. She studies the genetic structures of little insects called springtails. She's been studying them since her honors degree, and she has a soft spot for them.
Springtails are actually hexapods. They predate the evolution of insects, really. So they have quite an old evolutionary history. They have six legs, look a bit worm-like. They also have, obviously, the mouth parts, the eye spots, and then antenna. But interestingly, they've got a furca, or a springing organ, that actually sits on their abdomen. So when disturbed, they flick the springing organ downward, and they actually do these backward somersaults, hence the name springtails. They belong to the order Calambula, and they range from about 0.5 millimeters, that being your smallest, to about 3 millimeters. And it's quite a diverse group with four families.
I did not know that springtails existed until I met Dr. Monsanto. But after listening to her, I think I've also developed a soft spot for them.
I think we all have a favorite. Mine would have to be my study organism since my honors, Cryptopagus antarcticus trevae, which is actually a species that is endemic to Marion Island, so it's not found anywhere. So it's a little black metallic blue species, so they're very easy to see in comparison to some of the other springtails.
Little cute metallic blue creatures that do somersaults? Sign me up! Okay, but what role do springtails play in the ecology of Marion Island?
Marion Island essentially lacks megafauna, or mega herbivores. So these little critters perform an important ecological role of herbivory, and they're also detritivores. So they'll feed on dead organic matter, they assist with soil nutrient cycling, and they also serve as prey for larger microinvertebrates, macroinvertebrates.
By the way, springtails exist everywhere on the planet. You can even find some in your garden. But the Marion Island species are unique to Marion Island.
They're hugely abundant on Marion, so it's easy to obtain individuals from Marion. The amount of individuals that we do obtain is actually a fraction of the total population, so there's no larger effect on taking a few individuals for some genomic work.
The springtails on Marion Island are important because they help scientists get a picture of soil health and ecotoxicology. And scientists can also map their genomes to understand how the species is faring.
So on Marion now, for instance, we collected a whole lot of vegetation samples across one area where we physically wanted to target a landscape barrier. And so we created a transect across this barrier and we collected a whole lot of samples and we set up these Tilgrin-Verlies funnels, which is essentially just a funnel with a mesh that sits on the funnel. And at the bottom of the funnel, you'll have a collection jar with ethanol. And you'll put your vegetation sample on that mesh and you just leave it to stand for a good few days. And as the vegetation starts to dry out, the springtails or organisms will move away from the surface and they find themselves eventually falling through the funnel and into the ethanol. You can then add a light source on top, and that light source will also speed up the process if need be.
Although the springtails are visible to the naked eye, the scientists need microscopes to identify the specific species. After that, they do DNA extraction to map the genomes of springtails.
So we'll have sequence data from every single individual from every single side, and we'll be able to then see exactly how different are individuals from one another, how far were they able to disperse, is there a genetic break or barrier to gene flow.
Back at their labs at the University of Johannesburg, Dr. Monsanto and her team will do next-generation genomic sequencing to increase the resolution of the genomic data. It's kind of like zooming in on a picture to see all the little pixels that make it up. They analyze the genomic data and compare it to geographic data to learn how the genetic patterns of springtails change in different locations along their transect.
Prof. David Hedin will provide us with high-resolution maps where we can actually see exactly the intricate landscape detail and overlay that onto the genetic data.
Remember, a transect is a chosen section of a geography to use for a study.
You know, one thing to note with looking at landscape work is really to understand the landscape from the perspective of the study organism. And in this case, something being so small, a 10, 20, 30 meter distance is really huge for them to overcome. It's important to really understand how organisms, you know, interacting with their environment, what features could influence or promote their movement, specifically in the context of climatic changes. Mm-hmm. And springtails act as proxies, really, to understand that because they're so abundant, they're so ecologically important, and they're easy to study and obtain.
Let's keep our focus on the insect level for a moment. Here is another researcher who really cares about insects.
Yeah, a tiny little creature with six legs that crawls around on the Southern Ocean Islands, living in amongst rocks and plants.
Meet Naomi Monk, a PhD researcher from Australia, affiliated with the University of Pretoria. She is doing her research on weevils.
I have a really big PhD project that aims to project features for the terrestrial biodiversity of the Southern Ocean Islands broadly, but I'm using the model group of the weevils, which is a type of beetle.
Weevils might look like just teeny little bugs to the uneducated observer, but under a microscope, their full beauty is revealed.
So picture a very small, round creature that's no bigger than, the biggest we get is about a centimetre, so very small. Usually half a centimetre in size. And they have six legs because they're an insect. They have little antennae that reach out the front and sense what's in front of them. But under the microscope, some of the species in particular have the most iridescent type scales, very tiny little pear-shaped scales or hair-like scales that reflect light back, bluish green. Some will also have like a brownish orange tinge to them. So yeah, they can be very beautiful when they're viewed up close.
Iridescent rainbow bugs. Sign me up. I'm here for it.
The exciting thing about the weevils of the Southern Ocean Islands is they are not just diverse in where they live, but they're also diverse in what they eat. So some of them specialize in eating algae on the coast. Some of them specialize in eating lichen and mosses in the interior, where there's just rocks and mosses and lichen, that's all that lives. And others specialize in eating plants like the Azarella cushion. They also will eat grasses. They're very adaptable, the ones that eat the plants.
So what kind of field work did Naomi have to do on Marion Island to better understand weevils? Well, first she had to find them, which is not as simple as it sounds in a landscape like Marion Island.
When we first arrived and were waiting to go onto the island, the mountains of Marion were covered in a blanket of snow. And I thought instantly that I was not going to be able to find the species that I needed to, that frequent the high areas where they live under the rocks. And I wouldn't have been able to find them under the rocks in all that snow. But thankfully for me, I was able to find some really nice weather windows and get up to sample in areas that I initially didn't even think was going to be possible. So we were very lucky. We got a lot done given our very short time period. It's been exciting. And I look forward to seeing what I get in the lab.
You think you're dedicated to your job? Not as dedicated as Naomi. Picture her on her hands and knees in an unforgiving landscape,
peering into crevices and cracks in the vegetation or in rocks,
scouring a 10 square meter site, and then gently picking up weevils with a pair of tweezers.
So it was what we call active searching for a set period of time, which is usually 30 to 60 minutes, to properly survey a small area, which was a site that was already identified by the previous people that had carried out this work. So we made sure that we tried to revisit the same area so that we could have this comparative long-term data. And then, yeah, sampling to take back to the lab.
Back in the lab, Naomi does microscope work to identify each weevil's species.
On Marion Island, there's 6 recognized species, but I also need to identify which sex they are. And then once I've done that, I can begin with the measurements of the body size data that I'm after. So yeah, it's not always as easy as you would think, identifying a weevil under the microscope. A lot of them are quite similar in features, and there's certain key characteristics that we need to look for to make sure that we formally identify them properly. And some of them are very particular in what you need to look for. For instance, there's 2 genus. To tell them apart, you need to look at the mouth parts, and you look to see how many labial pulps they have, which is little bumps inside their mouth. And one of them, one genus, has 2 labial pulps and the other has 3. So under a microscope, you can count how many little bumps are inside the mouth part. But obviously, you can't tell that in the field. So in the field, you're relying on a few characteristics of body shape and the way where they're living, the habitat type, to try and give you an indication of which species you're collecting. You can get a pretty good indication.
Studying weevils on Marion Island is important because they are key indicator species for how the general biodiversity is getting on. Weevils are under threat by an invasive species, which is causing a massive amount of damage on Marion Island, the mouse.
The mice were predating quite heavily on certain species of weevils, for sure, when the populations were booming. And we haven't had a check-in for probably about a decade now.
You might have heard of a project called Mouse Free Marion. It is trying to figure out the best way to get rid of all the mice that have infested the island.
So this is exciting to be able to get some more baseline data before that project kicks off. And then hopefully we'll have some great things for them to compare as the island looks to recover afterwards.
Let's find out more about why mice are a threat to more than just those adorable little rainbow iridescent weevils.
Yeah, my name's Keith Springer and I'm the operations manager for the Mouse Free Marion Project. And the Mouse Free Marion Project itself is a partnership between the Department of Forestry, Fisheries and Environment, the South African government, and BirdLife South Africa. And the goal of the project is to eradicate mice from Marion Island.
Mice arrived along with humans back when people first started sailing to Marion Island, either just to check it out and map it or to exploit its resources, mostly seals and whales for their blubber.
So to summarise, the mice have been there for about 200 years or a little more. Primarily they were considered to be eating invertebrates as the main prey item in their diet. And over that time, they have eaten themselves out of invertebrates and have switched largely to seabirds as an alternate form of protein to stay alive in that harsh subantarctic environment.
Okay, let's just pause for a second to let that sink in. The humble house mouse has become a predator of very large seabirds, like albatross and giant petrels, because the birds haven't had time to evolve defenses against predation. Mice are omnivores. They will eat anything if they are hungry. And they are eating some of the most spectacular and endangered birds on the planet while they sleep on their nests.
So this has been going on now for some 20 years. So that has led to a significant predation toll on seabirds on Marion Island, right from small tiny burrow nesting petrels right through to wandering albatross chicks and even adults. So the largest seabird on the planet still being eaten by mice.
We'll hear more about albatross and other birds later in this episode. All the scientists and specialists agree. The mice have to be eradicated as soon as possible if the biodiversity from our tiny little weevils to our giant albatross are going to survive. It's crucial to the protection of Marion Island.
After some feasibility studies, the first one being in 2015, the solution, if you like to call it that, was to look to eradicate mice by aerial distribution of a rhodecticide bait. And this is a technique which has been used globally now on over 1,000 islands, so it's not null, but it's been going on in variations of this sort of main methodology for over 30 years now. So in that time, there's been a large body of experience built up, and we've tapped into that experience.
The Mouse Free Marion team has put a lot of time and effort into mapping best practice globally in rodent eradication from fragile island ecosystems.
One of our mantras is we're not looking to come up with new methods or novel methods to eradicate mice. We're looking for something that has a proven track record. And so while a number of suggestions are sometimes made to us about why don't you try this and why don't you try that, at the end of the day, none of those alternative suggestions have any track record. They might work, they might not. And when we look at the details of some of these suggestions, most of them would not. And the reason for that is that the sort of definition of eradication is every last one. If we miss one, or a pregnant female or a pair, then we've failed. So the repopulation starts all over again. Within a few years, you're back to where you started.
On this voyage, the Mouse Free Marion team were heading out to run some trials to gather data about how best to distribute the bait that will eradicate every last mouse.
2021, there was an eradication attempt on mice on Gough Island in the South Atlantic, which was unsuccessful. And then in 2023, there was a mouse eradication attempt on Midway Atoll in the North Pacific, which also was unsuccessful. Those islands were really disparate in their climate, their ecology, vegetation. Pretty much they were as different as two islands could get. The one thing they had in common was that mice were eating albatross on each of them, as they are on Marion. So with two failed eradications after pretty much 15 years of almost solid successes, that forced us to stop and just take a step back and look at what was going on those islands and were there any lessons that could be learned that we could apply to Marion with a view to enhancing the likelihood of a successful eradication on Marion. So to do that, we at Mouse Free Marion Project and some international colleagues convened an international workshop on mice eradication, and it was held in late 2023. And the format of that workshop took the form of tabling about five hypotheses and then discussing those hypotheses in the light of Midway and Gough. One of the things that came out of the workshop was that there was probably a greater need for research at an individual island level. And this sounds a bit weird, but we plan everything with the expectation that they will be successful. And that's been informed by the very high success rate in recent decades. At the workshop, we started saying, well, there's a number of data we could have collected prior to the eradication, which might have informed, you know, the outcome. And so should we be doing some of our planning for failure, planning so if it does fail, we've got some more data to interrogate and to investigate, and does that shed any light on the outcome? So from that, the Mouse Free Marion Project commissioned a research plan specifically for Marion Island to answer some questions about bait and about mice and you know, particularly in the marine environment.
As you can tell, it's really important to figure out exactly how much bait should be laid out over the test area in order to determine how effective it will be.
We're now implementing the first stage of the trials outlined in that research plan. So for this voyage, we're looking to undertake a trial using toxic bait over about a 9-hectare area. And in its simplest terms, that's a grid 300 metres long by 300 metres wide. And that'll be a better chance to evaluate that sort of weathering process. And in that second one, we'll also use a smaller pellet, about a third of the size. And again, we want to know, does a pellet with smaller mass but a greater surface area of pellet relative to its weight, does that weather more quickly in that environment, or is it broken down by invertebrates more quickly in that environment than the larger pellets? The advantage of considering a smaller pellet is that when dispersed by helicopter, there's a lot more of them, so the encounter rate for mice out and about foraging is higher. But this one comes into the more novel methodology, so we're interested to see if it might play a potential part in our eradication design, or whether possibly it might wither away too quickly, or it might be eaten by slugs or other invertebrates and be taken out of circulation too soon.
The Mouse-Free Marion team will build out their full eradication plan based on these outcomes, as well as other trials that will take place next year.
So eradication has the advantage that if you can carry it out successfully, that issue of mice impact on Marion's ecosystem is gone. And as long as the biosecurity measures are robust enough to prevent reinvasion of mice subsequently, or any other predators for that matter, then the sort of conservation gains are locked in.
If it works, and I really hope it does, and all the mice are eradicated, the likelihood is really high that the endangered seabird species will recover relatively quickly.
We've seen from other islands a noticeable difference in the abundance of seabirds within 4 or 5 years. And we have Prince Edward Island as a sort of touchstone 19 kilometres away, so we know what a mouse-free island in these waters looks like in terms of abundance of birds and invertebrates and vegetation. And because, of course, mice also impact vegetation in a number of ways.
To find out more about the Mouse-Free Marion project or to support it with donations, check out their website. We've put the link in our show notes, or you can just Google it. When you visit that website, you'll see some pretty horrifying images and videos of mice eating seabird chicks and generally just causing ecological havoc. And you can also read up more on the studies that they've done about the bait and its potential effects on other species. The trials that were run on the Marion 2025 takeover voyage takes us one step closer to getting rid of the mice and protecting all the species on Marion Island. Once the team complete running their tests, they will calculate exactly how much rodent bait needs to be distributed over the entire island, and then they'll set up a logistical plan for spreading that bait by helicopter. If you feel sorry for the mice, don't, because you haven't yet met the incredible seabirds that they're eating alive.
Mice eating burrowing petrels largely goes unseen and unrecorded. It doesn't capture the public imagination in the same way as attacks on albatross do. There were no native mammals on Marion, so having one is has sort of really upset the ecological balance on the island. I think the key take-home message is the fact that it's South Africa's only special nature reserve, and its designation is because of the incredible natural values on the island, and mice threaten those. And if we walk away from it, we think that most of the bird species on Marion will become extinct, or at least locally extinct, in our lifetimes.
Time to focus on our feathered friends. And time to meet some very knowledgeable birders.
That's kind of where my love for seabirds began, because I enjoyed working with them so much and rehabilitating them and getting them to the point where you can get them back to the environment. But what does their environment look like? How can you actually protect them in their environment?
This is Rhiannon Gill, who had just spent a year as a field assistant specializing in birds on Marion Island. We talked on the return voyage. She used to work for the South African Foundation for the Conservation of Coastal Birds and then got signed on for a year on Marion under the South African Polar Research Infrastructure, which many researchers on the voyage are affiliated with. You've heard from a few of them already this season, and you'll hear from others later.
Seeing them in their natural environment was just wow, because how they behave when they're in a captive environment can be very different and very stressful as opposed to seeing them in the natural environment.
One of the most famous birds on Marion Island are the few species of albatross that breed there. Albatross are the largest seabird, and Rhiannon's job was to monitor them for a whole year.
I guess the key thing that makes them stand out to a lot of people, especially if you come from watching David Attenborough's documentaries, The Life of Birds, you would have learned about the bird with the biggest wingspan. So, you know, almost 3-meter wingspan. Its life is basically, I find a place to settle down, which tends to be a selection of islands. I find a partner, lay an egg. You know, I raise this chick and then I leave it to fend for itself and hope that it will return to the same place to do the same thing and have its own family.
I was so lucky to see some albatross through my binoculars from the ship and also on one short day trip that was allowed for the ship-based team. I can testify that these are incredible creatures. Their huge wingspan is breathtaking. The way they glide in flight is majestic. These adjectives might sound trite, but really, they are so true. And Rhiannon got to observe albatross every day for a whole year. So she has some really special insight into these birds and their behavior.
Marion, as well as the Prince Edward Islands, hosts some of the biggest colonies of these species. So it's very important that we are protecting them, because if we lose those species from this island, we lose a huge portion of the actual population of wandering albatrosses. Something like 40% of their population nests on the Prince Edward Islands. So, you know, it's really important that we protect them. One thing I found was every individual has their own little personalities and little quips that you get to learn. You know, when you first watch them come to the island and they've been at sea, when they leave the island as fledglings, they don't come back until they're about 5. They spend all that time at sea just sustaining themselves. And then when they're old enough, they'll start coming back to the islands that they were raised on. So you hope that the ones that left Marion come back to Marion. With our fledglings, we put a metal ring on their left foot. And so if it does come back to the island, you can be like, oh, wow, okay, that one we put a ring on 5 years ago. So we can actually see they are returning to the island and they are coming back to breed. But when they return to the island, they might not breed straight away. So it's going to be a process. They have to come back and find a mate. And that's one thing you get to watch. You get to see these groups coming together and sort of displaying and communicating, just doing like a mating dance. So almost like if you go out to a bar and you're going to pick up a partner, you're going to have your certain things and ways that you behave that attract somebody, and they're going to do the same thing. You can relate to it so easily without actually knowing what they're talking about or what they're saying to each other. So most of my work is purely just observations. So you have, with the albatrosses and with the northern giant petrels, you have 3 monitoring colonies. As soon as the birds come back to breed, you set up the colony. So the moment a bird starts to nest and there's an egg laid, you mark the nest. And then once you've got your colony set up, because it's within a certain boundary, you then it's usually every 2 weeks, sometimes it's a little bit less than 2 weeks, you're going back into that colony to assess, you know, have the eggs hatched, have the eggs failed, how are the partners doing? You're also recording which birds are coming back to breed. So then you have records of the partners that are still together. Has there been a split? And you might have one bird is now with a new partner, so you can see how their sort of relationships work. And then from there on, once you have the chicks, you're assessing, does the chick actually get to the age where it can fledge and leave the island?
Replacing Rhiannon are 2 new birders, Andile Kuzwayo and Yana Rao, field assistants who will be carrying on the long-term monitoring and observation work of birds on Marion Island.
An average day would be us going, me and Yana, because we are both doing the same work. Sometimes we need to help each other because we won't be able to handle the animals on our own. My name is Andile Kuzwayo.
My name is Yana Rao, and just like Andy, I'm also a birder with SAPRI, and we're going to collect long-term data on the seabirds there, mainly focusing on wandering albatross, giant petrels, and grey-headed albatross.
So I would think we would probably go out to the field and try to observe the birds that we see, either the wandering albatross or the giant petrels. And we have to try and see if they've already been tagged. If they have been tagged before, we will note it down to say that this animal has returned to the island.
Yeah. So to tag an albatross is a really special thing. Only a handful of people in the world can ever say they've done that. So you cannot practice to tag an albatross if you've never handled an albatross. It'll be a new thing for both me and Andy. But the concept is always the same when it comes to banding birds, is they get a metal ring put onto either one of the legs. The ring is always specially made for that animal so that it fits it properly and that it doesn't cause any harm. It's a special, unique metal ring that can't rust or anything, and it has a special code on it, and it has a little engraved marking on it. And some of the banding that we'll be doing is color banding as well, so that we can see differences between maybe sexes, or so it's easier to distinguish a specific bird just by quickly looking at what color band does it have on the leg. It's done with very big pliers.
For the next 3 weeks or so,
yes.
They will be teaching us how to handle the birds properly so that we don't stress them or freak them out. Because they told us that even when we're approaching, we have to be considerate.
Mm-hmm.
Like, don't just rush and try and catch it as if you're catching a chicken, because that will not work. It might just fly off.
Birders working to put bans on albatross and other big species like giant petrels have to wear special oil skins when doing so because, well, I'll let them tell you why.
We've been told that when sometimes handling the birds, they sometimes vomit on you. They will vomit some oil-ish substance with some food and all of that.
Yeah.
And it tends to have a very strong scent. So the oil skins help so that the scent doesn't stick on us.
Mm-hmm.
And when we go back and we're done, we can easily just wash it and we can continue with our day.
Yes.
So that when we return to base, we don't stink up the whole kitchen or the dining hall.
Yeah. And it's also just done so that if we then handle the bird afterwards, that we don't get that oil on the other bird, and then it affects its waterproofness and all of that sort of stuff.
The birders record all their observations in notebooks that are kept dry in Ziploc bags. See, sometimes science is not that high tech. And then they back up all their observations on computer databases once they're back at base after each day in the field. I got so lucky on the day that us ship-based team members were allowed to go to the island. We were only allowed to leave base if we were accompanied by field assistants who had the correct permits. And who did I bump into but Jana and Andile back from their observations? They offered to take me for a walk, and we went out to have a closer look at a couple of albatross nests. It's really hard to describe how incredibly adorable an albatross chick is. First, even though it's a baby, it's pretty massive. I'd say it's the size of like a small Labrador, not even a Labrador puppy. And they are fluffy. Whatever level of fluff you're imagining right now, add 100% more fluff. And then make it snow white, because we're looking at wandering albatross chicks. They sit there innocently on their exposed nests with big baby eyes, patiently waiting for their parents, who mate for life, by the way, to bring them a meal. I felt so privileged to have gotten a tiny first-hand glimpse of some of the wonders that Marion Island field researchers get to see every day for an entire year. As well as the albatross, there are many other gorgeous and vulnerable birds that live on and around Marion Island, including great petrels, crozier shags, skuas, sheathbills, prions, seagulls, and more. Here's Eleanor Weideman from SAPRI telling us more about some of these birds.
I was one of the birders. That was in 2021, 2022, so M78 was my team, my people. Yeah, it was the best year of my life. It was a bit different to how it is set up now. So at that time, they didn't have dedicated long-term birders. So they split that long-term work amongst the three birders that were there. So I did a third of the long-term monitoring, and then the rest was a project on the avian scavengers on the island, which was super interesting. It was focused on the skuas, the paddies or the sheathbills, paddies as they're affectionately known, and the culp gulls. So we were looking at their foraging ecology, how it's changed over time. We did a lot of breeding success monitoring of the skuas, GPS deployments, GLS deployments, basically trying to figure out what are these birds doing and how they're acting in the past, now, and then the idea is look at it post-mouse eradication, because their foraging ecology has changed a lot in relation to changes come about because of the mice. As an example, the paddies or sheathbills, they used to forage mostly in the mires, eating insects. And then as the insects have declined because of the mice, the sheathbills have actually moved more into the penguin colonies and the intertidal zone. So we're interested to see, does their foraging change after the eradication? And is that a good like bioindicator of positive restoration projects.
I hope this little glimpse of some of the bird research taking place on Marion Island has inspired you to find out more. If you're into birds and you haven't yet discovered seabirds, I strongly recommend you expand your bird interests because you won't be disappointed. They're all so beautiful and so cool. A great resource for learning more about seabirds is the book Guide to Seabirds of Southern Africa, written by Professor Peter Ryan, who is a very famous birder who has spent probably cumulatively many years on Marion Island itself and many, many voyages on the S.A. Agulhas and other ships. You can also check out the websites BirdLife South Africa and SANCOB. We'll add the links in the show notes. I hope you've enjoyed this short tour around some of the research taking place on Marion Island from the perspective of the insect life and the incredibly special bird species that live there, as well as understanding a little bit more about the furry threats from those bad, bad mice. Although the mice have to be eradicated, if it's humanly possible, we should do that. But the weevils and the albatross and all the other birds, they're part of this beautiful ecosystem that can teach us so much about life on this planet and how it is all connected. Naomi Monk puts it really well.
Look, I think every bit of biodiversity is valuable. The big, beautiful albatrosses right down to the teeny tiny creatures hiding under the rocks. They all took such a long time to evolve and become part of the amazing biodiversity that surrounds us. It's hard to appreciate things you can't see, and I understand that. Once you understand why you would protect an albatross, it's easy to understand why you would protect a weevil that only lives in one place of the world. Still, it's the only place you'll ever find it. So big or small, they still hold an important part of the story of life, really, and something that we should treasure.
Everything you're listening to in this season was recorded aboard the S.A. Agulhas II, South Africa's national scientific research vessel, in April and May 2025, during the Marion Relief Voyage, where I was lucky to be the writer and podcaster in residence for 33 days. I spent that time befriending scientists and technical experts who were headed to or from Marion Island and inviting, okay, sometimes begging them to sit down with me and my microphone to tell us all more about their work. Picture us sitting in the ship's library, wearing fleece zip-ups and maybe beanies. It was cold in that library, with the wild ocean visible outside the portholes. The mic is on a little tripod on one of those non-slip mats to stop things sliding around as the ship moves with the water. Sometimes albatross are visible through the portal, gliding alongside us for a while. The weather changes almost by the minute. We settle into our chairs, and I press record. There are still two episodes to go and other scientists to meet. Tune in for our next episode, where we dive into the waters around the ship and the island and explore more about the fauna that live in the oceans near Marion Island, including penguins, whales, seals, and orcas. Peak predators ahoy! This podcast was created and recorded and produced by me, Mahita Ikhani, with loads of production assistance from Andrew Burnett, who also did all the sound editing and sound design. My berth on the S.A. Agulhas II for the 2025 Marion Relief Voyage was provided by the Artists and Writers Project for SANAP. That project is directed by Professor Sean Lavery and Professor Jean Brunrit. I'm so grateful to both of them for trusting me to be their writer in residence and helping me prep for the voyage. Thank you also to Dr. Adrienne van Eden Wharton for helping me get myself organized. She was the artist in residence in 2024. Huge thanks to the guests who appear on this episode: Dr. Daniela Monsanto from the University of Johannesburg, Camilla Smythe, Chandler Patel, Andile Kuzwayo, Rhiannon Gill, Yana Rao, and Eleanor Weideman from SAPRI, the South African Polar Research Infrastructure, Naomi Monk, affiliated with the University of Pretoria, and Dr. Keith Springer from the Mouse Free Marion Project. The production of this podcast was funded by the South African Research Chair in Science Communication, which is funded by the South African National Research Foundation. I'm honored to be the chairholder of that SARCI. The distribution and marketing of the Academic Citizen is done by Fumani Draga. huge thanks to the captain, officers and crew of the S.A. Gullis 2 for keeping me and all fellow passengers on this voyage safe and well and well-fed. To find out more about the South African National Antarctic Program, the S.A. Gullis 2 and the Prince Edward Islands, check out www.sanap.ac.za. Just a note, all of the guests on this season are speaking in their personal capacity, and their views should not be taken to represent the organizations that they're part of.